Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Oh, hello, dear friends. Welcome to Someone Who Isn't Me, episode number 39. As I'm more than mildly obsessed with the numbers 3 and 9, I'm glad that such an auspicious episode should feature singer, frontman and author Davey Havok of AFI, Black Audio, Extremist and Dreamcar. In this episode, we discuss AFI's fabulous new album Bodies and some of the themes contained therein. Bodies is the California band's 11th studio album, and it came out at the start of June 2021. And we talk about where it ranks within their body of work for the pair of us. We discuss discovering music at an early age via Thrasher magazine, the importance of developing an aesthetic sensibility for the creation of good art and music, magical intent in the creative process, great lyricists, and the benefits of a good pedicure. The portrait I painted of him for the cover of this episode is oil, acrylic and ink, and I believe I failed somewhat in portraying his well-shaped brows. And if you enjoy this episode and the discussion of the mystical nature of creativity, remember that there are 38 other episodes with artists such as Maynard James Keenan, Laura Jane Grace, Jazz Coleman, Tom DeLonge, Billy Corgan, Kat Von D and Alan Moore, etc. I don't have anything to hawk particularly other than some prints of a few paintings via my page on the Death Wish web store, the link for which is in my Instagram bio, which is at Daniel P. Carter, and in the show notes. So without further ado, this is Davey Havok from AFI. Enjoy. Thank you for doing this, by the way. Oh,
thank you for having me, Daniel P.
My pleasure. And I will apologize now because I feel like We've done a couple of things, like you did the interview for Radio One, and then I did the thing with you guys for your competition winners.
Yes, so which is very kind of you.
No, that's fine, but I'm just saying if I start repeating myself, I apologize.
I think it's a great idea because if I don't repeat myself, then we have to wonder which of the answers was correct. And
nice.
We can check them against each other and see if they gel.
But you said last time.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
You know, here's the thing. Let's start off hot. Let's start off with the important business. I just realized that what people don't know about me, that you don't know about me, Daniel, let's talk about me, is I've never had a pedicure
ever.
Isn't that shocking? I'm shocked just to say it aloud.
Well, the thing is, I would normally say the same thing, but I was very lucky because I met my wife when we were kids.
Yes.
And she studied she studied beauty therapy and things like that, and one of the things she did was reflexology and pedicures. So I was literally guinea pig while she was learning stuff. So that's the only reason I've had a pedicure.
That is a treat. I was years and years and years ago when I was a kid, I was with an esthetician for a moment who would do my brows for me. And well, I guess she was a stylist. I don't know what they did, but my brows were getting did.
Nice.
And I had to do that in high school by myself, which was dangerous.
Yeah,
you which can was dangerous.
A little overboard.
And yes, I wouldn't as a kid in high school, for fear of many repercussions, not simply damaging my eyebrows, but the social and familial damage that would be done by more extreme brows. I was subtle with it, but a good example, a cautionary tale of what happens when one such as myself does their own brows can be seen in photos of me while on tour for Sing the Sorrow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it looks like I, you know, in modern times, a friend of mine who I'd met in modern times who was young and too young to know what AFI is, you know, not 35 years old or 45 years old. And so she's like, oh, you were in some band or something. Yeah. And something about like alcohol. I'm like, yeah, I don't drink. And she said, oh yeah, I figured you were a tweaker because I saw these old pictures of you and I saw your eyebrows. I said that. Yeah, I can explain.
Wow.
Now I'm definitely going to have to go and check those out.
You know, we were coming out of the 90s. So what I was trying for, Daniel, were the 90s, you know, the 90s brow was a thin wisp of a 60s brow.
Yeah, like a John Waters moustache.
Yes,
of a brow.
Yes, yeah, and you'd go up above the brow ridge and you know fill it in, like the like a good queen. And I didn't know how to do that on the road by myself, and I couldn't go out. I didn't have time to go find someone to properly do my brows. So I looked pretty horrifying. So thanks for having me, Dan.
Well, I'm glad that this is where we've started.
Are you? Because I'm not. It was my fault. I did it to myself. This is terrible. Okay, Dan.
Pedicure tips. Pedicures are important.
Agreed.
Brows. This is a great start, I think.
Okay.
I was going to say that I was going to get to a point where I said that you're an aesthetician. Maybe, no, aesthete.
An aesthete. You're
an aesthete, yes.
I believe aesthetics are very important. I believe they're very important. And I know you agree. And I think...
Not that you'd think it seeing me, but I do agree with you.
I know you. I know you well. Yes, admittedly, at first glance, if I passed Daniel P. Carter on the street, I wouldn't immediately think that man understands the importance of aesthetics. I don't mean that to be diminishing.
That's fine.
But I know you do. Because you're a wise man, Daniel, and you understand how people work. The reality is whether or not how that aesthetic is presented, to what extreme or subtlety or lack thereof, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying it's important. I'm not saying it is valuable, but I think that I strongly believe that aesthetics change things and move things because of people's perception, and we are a visual kind.
Yes. Well, it's a form of magic.
It's, yes. Yes. If we're going to, I mean, it's glamour. Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. It is a glamour, and it is in, yes, absolutely. Yes. It is a form of magic. So it's that art is a form of magic. Art is the true form of magic. And an aesthetic is an art form, whether it's conscious or not, being that it is magical, if you will. Thereby, it is an artistry, whether it's honed or not.
Yeah, it's an important thing as well, and I know it's something that's very important to you because you can see it in all your work across all the bands, but also how you present yourself, but also. You know, you and I have had conversations about things that's not to say there aren't other people in other bands that share our similar tastes. And I just feel like, you know, we can talk about the effects of and the importance of fashion and art, visual art, I mean.
Yes.
Within our world. And I feel that, you know, as soon as anyone is making art and writing songs in particular, they're a product of that person and everything that they surround themselves with. And I think that if you surround yourselves with things that are of a high aesthetic value and level, because you appreciate those things, not because you feel like there's going to be some weird kind of osmosis where it actually affects your work.
Oh, right.
But in a roundabout way, it does.
It does. It does. It does because of its inherent value. The reason that we're the same reason that it affects you is the same reason that you're attracted to it. You're attracted to it because it affects you. And thereby it has affected you. And when something affects you, it changes you to some extent, if only for a fleeting moment or a more lasting moment. And it moves you and it changes you and thereby changes your perception and changes your behavior. And then if you are creating, it changes what you create to some level, especially with greater and greater exposure to whatever that piece of art or that human or that moment or that experience is. And that's art, and that's what creates us. But the visual aspect of it is something that's very impactful, whether or not, like I said, whether or not it's a conscious intention of the person or the group creating that visual, and whether or not it's consciously understood by the consumer of that visual.
I mean, that doesn't really matter necessarily, though, does it?
No. None of
I mean,
it
it's a bonus.
None
it's
of it matters, Daniel. None of it matters.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it's the only thing that matters. None of it, that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you're aware of it or not. No, what matters is that it's happening. And that is the only thing that matters, unless nothing matters. Yeah. But if something matters, that's the only thing that matters. The end. Back to toes.
Yeah. Well, I was going to go through, like, I want to talk a lot about the album, because I made a ton of notes each time in preparation for doing the other interviews, and then never got around to asking you a bunch of stuff. So I'd like to do that. And obviously, because the record is coming imminently, that's kind of why we're talking. But then there's a bunch of other stuff I wanted to talk about, like the sort of chronology of how we got to this point and you know, you getting into music from an early age and what sort of things were moving you at that point.
Okay.
Yeah. So I heard you saying that skating had a huge part on that and your musical discovery.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So Daniel, my musical path was the following. My grandfather sang to me. My mother loved music. And my mother had records. So when I was a baby, I would learn the songs that my grandfather would sing to me. I would sing them at family functions. I would be given a wooden spoon and a quarter to sing to, like, my great grandparents and my great aunts and cousins and whatnot.
Wow.
Somewhere in the middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania. I can't think of the city right now, but it doesn't matter. And I would listen to my mother's records and jump on the bed. She had the copy of the Rocky Horror Picture Show soundtrack that I talk about frequently. I would stare at that album cover, fascinated. Obviously, it led me to who I am today.
What age was it that when you had that?
When I was staring at the record?
Yeah, when you first heard Rocky Horror.
Well, I wasn't conscious of listening to it.
Ah, okay.
I must have, because Oh, I forgot this aspect of it. So I was fascinated with her records. She would put them on, but I only remember Diana Ross and Michael Jackson. I don't remember hearing Rocky Horror at that time. I remember staring at it, but being very, very familiar, of course, with the Rocky Horror soundtrack. My memory doesn't go back to being, I'm talking the ages of 2 to at the latest 5 years old. And then when I was 5 years old, my grandmother in Rochester, New York, asked me what I wanted for my birthday. And what I wanted for my birthday was an AC/DC record. And to date myself, Back in Black had just come out. So it just happened to be the new AC/DC record. And that's what I got for my birthday. I would then have my mom put on the record, which she hated and wanted to prevent me from listening to, telling me that it was devil music that tells you to kill your mother. And I vividly remember as a baby child, as a five-year-old, being baffled and saying, "What? No, it doesn't." And she said, "Yes, it does. This is devil music. It tells you to kill your, this type of music tells you to kill your mother. And I just remember being an innocent child saying,
"Wow."
Saying, "Where does it say that, Mom?" Innocently saying, "Where? Can you show me, oh my God, I'm listening." Because I didn't want to kill my mother. I was 5 years old.
Yeah.
So I was horrified at the prospect that I was listening to something that was telling me to kill my mother. I didn't like that. I was agreeing, "Oh, that's horrible. Show me where." And she got mad. She got mad because she couldn't show me where because they weren't saying that. Nobody's saying that. Except maybe the meat men. Oh, and the Misfits.
Yeah.
And then eventually I found the Misfits. So I could find the music that said, I need to find that band that says Kill Your Mother. My mom told me it was out there. She was a big Misfits fan in the 70s. So I listened to AC/DC as a 5-year-old. Great record.
Yeah.
Great record. Incredible. I know there's a lot of people who don't like the Brian era, but that's what started me. And then another big shift came when my folks got me a boombox, a 1-speaker boombox, around the time of the inception of the boombox, but mine was not big. It was just a little tape cassette player. I keep thinking it was my birthday. It might have been Christmas, but it was the early 80s. It was whenever those were released. And they allowed me to get 3 cassettes, which was very generous as part of this present. And I went to Tower Records in Sacramento, where I lived. I believe it was, I don't know if it was the first Tower, because that's where Tower came from. There were 2 in Sacramento at the time, but we went to Tower. The first 3 cassettes that I bought were Duran Duran, Men at Work, and Devo.
Wow, 2 out of 3 ain't bad.
Yeah, let's see. Duran Duran, Men at Work, and Devo. You don't like Men at Work? Or you don't like Duran Duran?
You know.
Oh, I love Duran Duran.
Okay, so yes, I agree. Of those 3, Men at Work is, I would say, great, but the lesser of the 3.
Yeah, they were like an Antipodean police. Yeah.
Yes. Well, yes, exactly. So, and that was indicative of what was going on in pop culture at the time, because I was a kid. And so New Wave, the British Invasion, the early electronic infused pop music, post-punk music was what was huge. And
such an incredible era for pop, I think, as well.
Oh, I mean, of course we agree on that. So, you know, if I had been a little bit older, it probably would have been Kiss, or I don't know, Journey, or you know, disco, but I wasn't. That was the age I was.
Imagine how different things would be if it had been. I mean, Kiss, right? I mean, we might have ended up somewhere near where we are.
But no.
Not really.
Yeah. Because, I mean, really what I was listening to obviously was, in fact, post-punk. And that allowed me. And at the time punk was, you know, also dead, as the punks would say, but had just finished being very, very big, which, you know, of course, paved the way to the music I'm talking about, and that being popular and new wave, and, you know, the terms being muddled and whatnot. Yeah. But so punks were around. So mall punks were there, and I was enamored and fascinated by mall punks. So I knew that was where I needed to be. I just didn't know how to get there, and I had Catholic oppression to deal with. And thereby, I was attracted to my kind.
Yeah, of course.
And so I was trying to find punk, and I was a child, and I was being met with resistance every step of the way. But to get to where you were going, Thrasher magazine, I found skateboarding. I became a poser child skateboarder, which was also very, very popular in the 80s. And in the 80s, skateboarding and punk rock were hand in hand, listeners. if you're not as old as us, which is not the case, which hasn't been the case since the 90s. Culture of skateboarding shifted drastically in the 90s, but before the 90s, it was a punk culture for many reasons we could get into, but we needn't. And thereby, the skateboarding magazine Thrasher was filled with punk music and ads for punk bands and records and t-shirts, and there was music sections in the magazine, notes from the underground and the Puss Zone, where Pusshead, the renowned artist who rose to fame via Metallica, like mainstream fame, but was previous to that involved in the punk scene, and did art for the Misfits and
But then he did Septic.
Yeah, his band was Septic Death.
Yeah,
he was in Septic Death.
Yeah,
and did the artwork for Septic Death, and that's why. And some other, and Zorlak skateboards, right?
Yeah,
plus that has Zorlak graphics. So it was all intertwined, and Thrasher magazine was really what taught me about the music, and led me from listening to that early Duran Duran and what was going on the radio to finding punk rock.
I find it interesting because I think that perfectly seems to sum up you, right?
I mean, a lot of me. Yeah, that does sum up.
Yeah, I mean, from a musical perspective, I mean, I don't mean on an, like, I'm not trying to cast you as some kind of two-dimensional.
No, sure, certainly.
Just one facet. But I mean,
clear. I have multiple. Yeah. I'm not just
there's
one
more
thing.
Going on. We've already
put me in a box.
Eyebrows.
don't put my eyebrows in a box.
But
you put my eyelashes in a box and they haven't come out for 20 years.
But yeah, I think that says a lot. And I think across everything that you do, like punk and hardcore and kind of new romantic and new wave.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, we are a product of the things that we consume.
I guess,
from an artistic level, as we said at the start. And I think that really comes through on this record.
I think so too. In a very acute way that we don't see in previous records as much. There are more of those early influences that are exposed more distinctly on this record. As you pointed out when we did our fan chat, I believe.
I think that's why it's my, and this isn't just me saying this because we're doing an interview right now, but I think it's my favorite record of you guys.
Man, mine too. But, and that means so much coming from you.
Yeah, but
so
I mean,
thank you.
Yeah,
me
I've
too.
I lived with it for a short period, but
same.
And I don't think it's that kind of sort of honeymoon period that you would have in a relationship, which is kind of relevant to this record as well in a certain degree, but I feel
do
like
you experience that. I actually have a tendency to not experience that with music that I consume.
Yeah.
To me, it's rare for me to, even with artists I love, for it to immediately strike me. I can generally tell immediately, I can tell this is great, but as far as where it's going to sit in the ranking of my favorites I don't know that immediately often. Sometimes, I mean, when Nick Cave released Push the Sky Away, that was very striking. That was one of those moments where I went, oh, holy fuck. You were already perfect, but now you're perfect in a different way. In a very new way for you. And I know that this is an important shift, and I can tell that this is going to remain one of my favorite of your records, and it has. But
I think everything he's done in those last few records has just been so, I mean, Murder Ballads was always my favorite. I don't know why. I think I had quite an affinity to that record because I remember I had a cassette of it, and when me and my wife would be driving around before we were married, like, we listened to that record, that tape, a lot. That still has really struck me. But I think with the last couple, like Skeleton Tree and Ghost Teen, I just feel like, it's just so heavy, man.
It is
and
a great, that, oh.
Yeah.
And I so feel tragic. Those, it's interesting. I put those three records together. I feel that, and Carnage as well.
Yeah.
Which is more minimal.
Yeah.
And
you
know, to be fair, they recorded it and of course it was going to be minimal. That is just Nick and Warren.
And
right?
Warren.
Yeah. So it's not a Bad Seeds records. Yeah. Right. So as far as the Bad Seeds records go, I too group those three. And to me, those three records sound very similar in my opinion and could be one long record.
Well, they are a triptych. He views them as a triptych.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Okay. So that makes sense. That makes sense to me. And that being said, not having known that he professes them to be a triptych, generally an artist who records something that similar two times in a row, yet three times in a row, I'm generally over it. But
yeah,
but with those records, I am of the opinion that he can keep doing that forever. I am good. But I think it's a unique circumstance because he's working so much with mood and lyrics and storytelling and you know, walls of music and escape and realms with that embrace of the poetry, which,
yeah,
you know, the poetry elevates the sounds and the way that it works off each other. It's such a different,
it's a really non-traditional way of writing songs.
Very non-traditional. The songwriting is very, very unique, and you know, comes from of course it comes from the folk world, I would feel, in the blues world, and intertwining that, and then there still is rock, but then anyway,
yeah, it comes from a very wounded place, I think.
Yeah,
anyway, right, as I've said to you before about how I see this record to be very open, and as I said before, I think a less emotionally guarded. I wanted to say last time that I feel the people being referenced in certain songs, I mean, they may be characters, however we wish to discuss this, I feel like
they're actually people.
Yeah, okay. And I feel like they're not going to be languishing in any kind of doubt as to whether or not is this song about me.
I don't think that's an unfair assessment. I don't think that's an unfair assessment. If we went through song by song, I think it's possible. Well, certainly the subjects, when there is a human subject involved, there are levels of symbolism to the archetype, if you will. But yes, admittedly, I would say that your sentiment is correct, that in a lot of the instances in Bodies, the subjects are distinct. Those subjects are nuanced, but yes, I think your suspicion would probably be correct for most of the cases that you feel that across the characters.
Yeah, but I
feel like that in even that is another level of honesty that is imbued in the song, because yeah, you can feel it, right? Or I could, or I'm assuming all this. So
yeah,
but it feels to me like that's the case. And
you're absolutely right. There is a greater frequency of that on this record than I would say there has been on any record, with the exception possibly of Burials. That occurs throughout the history of my lyric writing, I suppose I should say. I was going to say AFI, but it does occur throughout the history. But as far as a grouping of songs where what you're sensing could be argued, it can be argued, I believe, for more songs than any other release within the Bodies record for the different characters that are created within the lyrics. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's a great thing though.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I had no choice. I never have a choice. I try to have a choice sometimes. Sometimes I try to push in one way or another. And oftentimes a little nudge will be very fruitful, but oftentimes, more often than not, if I try to do something that I wasn't inclined to do in the first place, it just becomes forced, you know, it feels forced, I can't succeed at it. And that is a compliment to me. It's flattering to me that you recognize that you feel that it has value, especially because I do have a desire to write in that direct way, because it's difficult for me to do.
Why do you think that's happened more in this record? Is it because of, I mean, let's not get into it if you don't want to, but I'm assuming circumstances or just your approach to writing?
Both. Yeah. I mean, I think certainly it was my approach to writing has inclined me, being that I traditionally, looking at the majority of what I've written, certainly in regards to AFI, write in an arcane fashion in which there's words that are just bathed in symbolism and metaphor and simile and
yeah, but that's still here as well. That's a what bit. I'm saying.
Okay. I mean, that's really complimentary, because I really would like to balance the two. And there was a time period after, I would say, trying to weave the two styles together was something that I wanted to, I was going to say after Crash Love was initially what I was going to say, but then Burials was a very unique writing experience. And in after that with Blood, that's where I wanted to be both direct, but still infuse some of that poetry and see if I could accomplish that. And then I had another unique experience with Bodies, where my life led me in a very, very unique direction that I hadn't experienced before in my long, long life. And thus, being the obnoxious person that I am, I was very inclined to tell anyone who would listen about it via a record, via AFI. And still being inclined, as I was on Blood, my attempt was to balance those two, and having a new unique experience gave me a focus that was unique to Bodies while working within that inclination to balance those two techniques.
It feels like the whole record is about the balancing of polarities anyway.
Yes.
So that just becomes like an almost meta level of that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Wow, I didn't even recognize that, Daniel. But yes, of course. Wow. Yeah, of course it does. Yeah. Or the struggle of that balance and the confrontation of those polarities. And there's another one just in the inherent creation of that.
Yeah. Yeah, because like I said, those sort of like esoteric and, as you said, like archetypal elements are still well within them. You know, when we first talked on Radio One about I think it was when Escape from Los Angeles came out, and I said about the play on words about it being the city of angels, and you saying about I fell from like morning sun,
right,
and that obviously being,
you know, the
sun of
the morning.
Yeah. And things like that. But then also like tied to a tree as well, which has all these, this might just be me having a terrible habit of picking through things, knowing the sort of things that you're into and where our interests cross over in this sort of esoteric Venn diagram, me then going, oh, well, tied to a tree makes me think of, you know, the idea of gaining wisdom and Odin being tied to a tree. But then there's also this C.S. Lewis element to it about white hairs and, yep, and following down holes.
Yeah.
But then something is also in Celtic lore, which I think applies, and I don't know if this was any intention, but the idea that within sort of folklore in the Celtic tradition, there's the idea that if a person, well, a woman, but a person dies heartbroken, they would come back as a white hare and torment the person that was the culprit, I guess. Yeah, and then torment them until that person died, which is interesting.
Well, that's a chilling understanding of those relatively esoteric lyrics. Yes, Daniel, I'd say once again, you have a very, very valid interpretation of what's going on, especially in that song, which is, as you pointed out, extremely symbolic. Well, it has an extreme use of symbolism and metaphor and imagery and many, many references, both literal and philosophical in that regard. And it is, I really appreciate that, because I think those are all very, very accurate descriptions of the sentiment that's being confessed, I should say, in that song.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah. With that and also Back from the Flesh, I think those two, which have that that more brooding sort of slow burn feel to them, again, just balances out, because the record is, as we've said before, really propulsive. And I think that those moments where I'm feeling like the things that you're really into, as all of you as players and musicians, have come to the fore, and a lot of that is why the record feels like it has that sort of propulsiveness to it, like that kind of very 80s kind of post-punk feel. But yeah, those two then really balance it out beautifully, I think.
I agree. I'm so happy that those two made the record. I felt it was such an important part of that story, of that greater, not narrative, but the movement, as you're saying, and the propulsion and the body of work that is Bodies. And without those moments, it would really change the feel of the entire record. And
yeah,
those are fulcrums, and they're shifting points, and they're expanses that open up within the density of the tracks that surround them. And I think they're, of course, important as songs as within themselves, but they create the whole, and the whole would be completely different without them. And I'm very, very happy that the track listing is what it is, because it could have been many different things. You know, as you know, we write multiple songs for each release, and it's a matter of choosing them. And for me, I've said this before in interviews, I probably said this to you, this is my favorite AFI record. And that is due very much to that mood that you're talking about. And I think it's just wonderfully representative of who we are. And without this very specific track listing, it wouldn't create the same environment. Which I think is a very genuine and poignant environment for us right now, I believe. It is for me.
Yeah. Well, like I said, it's my favorite one.
Thanks, Daniel. Well, it's for you. So that means a lot.
Thanks.
Because that the record is the record is for you. So for you to have that reaction is very important. And
well, the beauty of all great art is it should feel somewhat for the person enjoying it and experiencing it anyway.
Yeah,
and I think that's
why it's it connects.
I should hope.
Yeah. I was curious, while we're talking about the whole kind of the theme of duality on the record. Again, this is me reading too much into everything.
I mean, you're probably reading what's right in front of you.
No, I don't know, because
explicit text that you happen to see.
Well, no. This is more about the way the record has been released, because you've been releasing the songs in pairs. And I was curious to know if you'd gone so far as to actually pair the songs up specifically for that purpose, to almost like counterbalance each drop. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, yeah, there was a very active choice in which songs we paired together to balance. Yeah. So each drop would have a mood in and of itself, even though it was two songs, to foreshadow the mood of what was to come as an entire body of work. That was certainly orchestrated, because how could you not?
Yeah, of course.
How could one not? If the choice to release music in that fashion was made, there'd have to be some thoughtfulness to the balance or the lack thereof. If it's
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess from a sonic perspective, yes, and mood perspective, but I was one, you know, me being me, I was curious if to see it had gone even further than that with certain pairings. As like counterpoints lyrically and thematically, I meant.
No, I can't admit to that.
Okay. I would have done if I'd have been you.
I'd like to say yes. Honestly, that if working alone.
Yeah.
As the lyricists and the intention, certainly that would have been done.
Yeah.
But yeah. As a group and understanding how people listen to music and how music is presented and consumed, I didn't even begin to try to push that one through because I understand the merit of the tonal balance or push and pull. And I respect that. But yes, that would be a great course to take.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you said that, you obviously have written, you write quite, prolifically when you're working on an album cycle, I guess, if we're viewing it that way.
Yeah.
And then certain things will make the grade and certain things will get cut off very early on. I'm curious because as I said, this record feels like there are moments, and I don't mean this to come off as some like weird backhanded compliment because I don't mean it like that. I mean it purely as a beautiful thing. But there are moments where it really makes me think of the bands that I know that you love and that I love. And I think that's part of the reason why it's connected. But was there a conscious decision to do this?
No. Those type of songs aren't essentially accidentally written. It just comes naturally to us in the writing process.
Yeah.
We write so many different types of songs and we gravitate toward some more than others. And luckily for me on this occasion, for whatever reason, you know, it doesn't always have to do with the song itself. It has to do with the people, you know, who are evaluating the songs at the time. And that very much begins with Jade and I and the place that we're in and where we are emotionally and, you know, whatever our internal perceptions of what we're trying to do or aren't trying to do. We never have an explicit conversation about it. It's just a matter of creating the music and then discussing, okay, which ones are our favorites, but not with any sort of greater intention other than picking what we, to minimize it, feel are the best songs. You know, what a best song is completely subjective. And so that subjectivity imparts our decision as to which the best songs are. And then that's extended to the whole band after the songs are really fleshed out and which each of us thinks are the best song for the album. But it's never an explicit conversation as to what the best album would be in tone or vibe.
And you've reached it regardless.
Thank you, Daniel. I feel in this way, in this time, with a case of bodies, I feel we have in a very unique way, in a very specific way, that in a very important way for me in looking at the history of our band. I'm very happy that we made this record, but that was a product of the selection and what we gravitated toward. And I'm very grateful that we all gravitated toward this particular body of music in relation to the greater body of music that was created during the bodies sessions. You know, yeah.
Lots of bodies.
Lots of them.
They're
laying all about.
Yeah.
Strewn everywhere.
It is a very carnal record, it seems, as well.
Yes. Yes, for better or worse.
Dare I say sexy?
Well, thank you. Dare to say.
Yeah, it's a terrible, it feels like such a terrible way of phrasing it, but I feel it's
well,
there.
Not contextually. Of course, everything is contextual. You know, relative to that. And, you know, that is complimentary because I don't think it's diminishing. That word is often used as, no, sexy is never diminishing. It's only a compliment.
Yeah, I agree, but it can, I don't know. It feels like it can be tainted with cheapness, and that's it can. Why I, that's why I'm was wary to use it.
Yeah. But in regards to what we're speaking of, it can only be complimentary.
Yeah. I feel like in Dulceria and On Your Back and Back from the Flesh in particular, it feels like, yeah, like quite a carnal record, which I think.
Wow. Yeah. You caught the Back from the Flesh. Yeah. And yet it's, yeah. And the carnality is, especially with Back from the Flesh, is certainly bathed in commentary.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, we're speaking with an understanding of what specifically we're talking about. So we know we're not talking about a Marvin Gaye song, but as I think of Marvin Gaye, and to describe something that is sexy, that's still fantastic.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We're just, there's a brutality in within the body sexiness, which is unavoidable.
Yeah.
You know, there's it's confrontational. For better or worse. You know, it's back to the duality.
With Dulceria as well, actually, another thing I wanted to ask about was obviously that that's the collaborative song with Billy, right?
Yeah. It was great.
So, yeah, because you did stuff with those guys when they were touring. Like, you came out and sung with them and stuff.
Yeah.
And you obviously have a wider kind of relationship. So how was that working with him? Because obviously, amongst you guys, it's obviously very close knit, especially between you and Jade.
Mm-hmm.
So then how was it then working? I mean, he's one of my favorite songwriters of all time. Yeah, I think he's fantastic. But I mean, how was that?
Well, you point to the true cause of the collaboration is that we as AFI, who have never collaborated with anyone before, view him as one of the best songwriters of our lifetime. And to have the opportunity to work with him was thrilling for us at this point in our existence as a band. So we took that opportunity, and it was great. My participation was very minimal. He and Jade wrote together, as I recall, a few times, on two of those occasions I joined. And but my participation was just watching, really. I believe Billy wanted me to participate and join to hear what my voice sounded like singing the melodies he was writing. And I knew that in the end, and I was thrilled at the prospect of this, that Billy would be writing the top line and I would be, I suspected at least, and that I would be writing the lyrics. And I sat and I watched Billy on bass and Jade on guitar, just kind of riffing off each other, and Billy writing top lines over these riffs. And after what I believe was 2 days, Jade compiled everything that had been written and at some point took it and took sections of each, well, not each, but took a few sections from the writing sessions and created Dulceria out of those parts. And it was months after. I thought it was a wash. And then months later, Jade said, listen to this. I went back to the Billy sessions and I put this together and I was moved. I said, this is fantastic. Let me write that.
Yeah.
And I wrote the lyric, which I feel is one of my best lyrics that I've written. I'm very, very fond of those words. And so much so, it was an interesting experience for me because it's the first song that this is something that rarely occurs in the history of AFI, because on occasion Jade has written the top line, for instance, Escape from Los Angeles, or
but then that's still within your, you know, the pair of you,
right?
Main songwriters,
correct. You raise the emotional point that I was trying to latch onto when I stuttered. So it was the first time someone outside of Jade that wrote a top line that I sang ever. And by the time the song was written and made the record and there was a pandemic, the song had just become the song and I'd forgotten, you know, who wrote what. And it was, I had so much emotional ownership to it and still do. which was an interesting experience. Not that I had any trepidation about embarking on that sort of songwriting effort, but I didn't really consider a moment where the song would truly just, to me, live as a song and not as something that Billy Corgan participated in.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's, to me, it's just,
it's interesting because I don't think I knew that you guys had written with him when I first heard that song.
Ah.
So it never came. So I must have missed that. I don't know what had happened, but I think I just listened to the song without sitting there with like a press release or whatever.
Yeah.
So I was just enjoying it and reacting to it, just, you know, in a very song. Just, yeah, yeah. As a, well, it is, but as a very, you know, without out that even not being a factor, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I went, and then when I saw that and then listened to it again, I'm like, oh yeah, I can hear it now. But I think that's a beautiful thing.
Agreed. Agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to me, that's how I felt when we wrote the song, when the song became what it was. I didn't feel that it sounded unlike something AFI would do. I felt like it sounded like a unique AFI song. And a very important AFI song, but I didn't feel like anyone would be shocked by you know, like, what this is? This is a reggae song?
Yeah. Men at Work.
Right. Upstrokes are wild, man. It's a wild.
Yeah. I don't know. I think, I don't know. I'm not getting into that. I'm not a fan.
Into Upstrokes. I mean, yeah, I like Bauhaus.
The Police. The Police, The Clash, yeah, Bauhaus, but that's slightly different.
What about Second Wave? I really like
like stuff like Specials and
English Beat.
Yeah,
General Public. Yeah, like the two.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I like all that, but then
we like all that, and that's it.
Yeah, but I still can't get away from thinking of Third and Fourth Wave.
Third Wave, we don't think about that. It's not discussed. Yeah. What about Stiff Little Fingers? No,
not particularly. Never really went there, to be honest.
Subhumans?
Yeah,
no,
not really.
Okay,
I'm probably nowhere near as cool as or my musical taste is nowhere near as cool as you would assume.
No, that can't be because you like the coolest music that only 10 of us like.
Yeah,
so you're already at the top.
Well, this is another thing I wanted to talk to you about because and it goes back to what we were saying about these kind of esoteric elements and the sort of the thematic elements to what you write. I had another thought today, but I don't want to say it because I don't know, because it's kind of a weird one. We'll talk about it at the end.
Okay.
But you know, we've talked about that whole period of bands like Coil and Psychic TV and Throbbing Gristle and stuff, and obviously there's a huge magical element to that, and we've discussed how art is a magical thing anyway.
Yeah.
Is that a conscious thing when you're working? Do you ever think that within those terms, or is it or is it an instinctive thing? Because I think, you know, great art is instinctive, and that is part of the magic of it.
That's interesting that you asked that question. So the answer isn't no. I've never really considered it consciously in that way. I've never considered the question that you're answer consciously, and the answer to the question is yes. On rare occasion, there is a consciousness to a desired effect of the creation in the regards to what you're saying. It's rare. If we're going especially to equate
I was gonna say, yeah, with lyrics, it is you know, Alan Moore has this thing that he's always talking about where you know, spells and spelling, you know, those things are you know, writing, the actual act of writing and
mm-hmm.
and creative writing is he views it as a magical spell, and I do as well to a certain degree.
Well, I'm just curious it certainly is to a certain degree, because the psychological effect of that act and the result it has on the consumer are defined. They're definitive.
Yeah.
You know, the change that it has upon you psychologically is something that can actually be charted, if you will. So, and being that, as you point out, that is the case for words and writing, and then me being the lyricist, that being as well as melodies, but that being my acute contribution, the most recognizable contribution. And as a listener who, if you are one who pays attention to lyrics, you really pay attention to lyrics for the most part. Someone who generally, I find that people tend to ignore lyrics and maybe pick up on a word or two here and sing a wrong lyric, or they are really curious as to what the intention of the song is, or what they're hearing something that they are reacting to. And because we know that, we know the effect of the lyric. Thereby, to harken back to your question, on occasion, which is rare, in the past, I have written with desired effect. And if we're going to use the term magic, interestingly, for better or worse, it would be the results that I have seen in regards to that intention that were most striking would have been a result, if we are to work in that terminology, of a black magic.
Wow.
Which means I'm going to get mine, Daniel.
Yeah, that's what they always say, but I don't know.
Yeah, what a win. So, wow. Took a minute. But it's rare. Only since you asked me that question must I consciously, honestly think about it and honestly answer yes. But it is rare. Generally, I naturally write. I understand that what I'm creating can have a far-reaching and perhaps long-lasting effect, but rarely am I looking for a specific
desired result.
Yeah. Yeah. Or a selfish result. Very rare.
Huh.
Very rare.
Who are your favorite lyricists, by the way?
Oh, man.
I know this could be like go on forever, but I'll just curious.
I'll just rattle them off. Elliot Smith, Ian Curtis. Mm-hmm. Robert Smith, Frank Black.
Yeah.
I think David Tibbett's great. Nick Cave, of course, Morrissey.
That's what I wanted to ask you about, was about Morrissey.
Absolutely. Oh my God. I
don't want to say it because it sounds like a weird compliment, but at the same time, it could be taken the wrong way. But I see a lot of, I don't know whether it's just this record or, but I see a lot of that.
Wow.
A lot of him in what you do.
Oh, it's interesting that what I was about to say as you were saying that. So that is wildly complimentary, because what I was going to say was Morrissey is Oscar Wilde. And it's interesting because, of course, he was influenced by Oscar Wilde. He's very forthwith about that. Yeah. But I don't find him to be, you know, a pale facsimile of Oscar Wilde, and yet it's so Oscar Wilde. And I don't feel he's trying to be Oscar Wilde. I know he loves Oscar Wilde. I may or may not have known of Oscar Wilde before I listened to The Smiths. I think I did, but it is because of Morrissey that I'm that familiar with Oscar Wilde. And I feel he was simply influenced by Oscar Wilde. It's so similar to Oscar Wilde, yet it is its own thing, and it's unique and unparalleled, in my opinion. He is shocking, like shockingly wonderful lyricist. It's incredible. Poignant. Incredible. It's artful. It's impactful. It's funny. How dare you, like Nick Cave, you know, the self-awareness and the humor while being scathing and unapologetic and thoughtful and intelligent. That's so rare. And that can be said for most of the writers that I named, except you would extract the humor from everybody except Nick and Moz. there's not a lot of laughs in Ian Curtis or Elliot Smith.
There is in Robert Smith, though.
Roberts, yes. Yes, I'm sorry.
There's a playfulness in that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Robert gets that accolade as well. But I mean, that's very flattering. Thank you, Daniel. I appreciate that. That's a compliment. It's not something that I consciously strive for, certainly at, you know.
No, I wasn't implying that. No. I just there's something there that I feel I could
I imagine that any turn of phrase that I naturally land upon, it comes from more of it's not from reading poetry. I wish I could say it were. It's not. It's I'm not a big poetry reader. I certainly read fiction far more than I read poetry, but
yeah,
any ability that I have to turn a phrase, I would say comes from ingesting those musical artists. Those are my favorite lyricists. There are more, I'm sure, that I've omitted that you could probably name. I do love David Tibet.
He's incredible.
It's incredible.
I'd love to meet that guy. I've not met him. Have you ever met him?
So interestingly, I've not met him, but through purchasing some of his fine art, I began an email relationship with him. Wow. And let me tell you, that exchange is exactly what you would dream it to be. It was like hanging out. I had a day with Robert Downey Jr.
Okay.
Same thing.
That's amazing.
So when you think of David Tibet and what he is like and what you imagine him to be like and what exchanging him would be like, that's exactly what it's like. In the same way that if you were to think of what hanging out with Robert Downey Jr., you'd think it'd be like, oh, he's exactly like Tony Stark, but funny and not a dick.
Yeah.
That's correct.
I only met him very briefly at a show in
David?
No, Downey.
What show?
Downey. What?
I'm sorry. When I say that, I want to be clear. I'm not friends with Robert Downey Jr. I've met him. I have a friend who is very, very good friends with Robert Downey Jr. So when I say Downey, I'm parroting the way my friend refers to his childhood friend. Though. Yes.
I found him to be wonderful.
Oh.
He was like, yeah, he was exactly as he said. And I think that's a beautiful thing. When you meet somebody and they are everything you expect them to be without the disappointment, that was a great thing.
Yes. You know? Yes. Mm. Especially when working with actors, where you should have we can't help but create this character surrounding these actors, which is absurd. It should be the opposite.
Yeah. It's always a weird one, isn't it? Because you kind of wonder when somebody's career is pretending to be another person dependent on whatever it is they're in.
Right.
You kind of wonder if you'll ever see what the real person is.
Right. Our inclination should be that I know nothing about this person other than they are a great actor, but what they are as a human being, I have no idea. We shouldn't be projecting these personalities and these lifestyles upon them, but we do, because I think it is, Daniel. I think we sense a typecast and typecasting is the thing.
Yeah, for sure. But then you must get that right. Do you feel like?
Yeah,
I don't know, because as
what you mean? Projecting? Yeah.
And again, I'm not. Again, we've already established that you are a multifaceted, wonderful human being that has a plethora of interests, and you're very well read. I'm just saying that other people's perception must be very much only what you give them within the records, right?
Yes. So it's a very interesting thing, because there's, you know, as it is with anybody that you don't really know, there's a certain amount of information that is there to be consumed to deduce what type of person this is, you know. Mm. And of course, people oftentimes choose the bits that they want.
Yeah.
That's the most frequent thing. The bits that they enjoy, they will oftentimes choose and create a persona around that and expect that persona and whatever it is. And those bits that are chosen are often chosen from a pool of a finite period of time.
Yeah.
You know? So it depends on it really depends on the person as to who they do or don't think I am. For instance, someone like yourself who has a deep knowledge of you are very versed and very, very educated and have done your homework on Davy Havoc and you're quite the professional for whatever reason, whether it's out of professionalism. Is that a word? Professionalism?
That's a word.
Yeah. Whether it's out of professionalism or actually enjoying what I do, either way, I really appreciate it. But
it's definitely more of the latter than the former.
Go on. Plus you recognize aspects that a lot of people aren't even presented with.
Mm.
So yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot of ideas of who I am and who I'm not. It's all fine.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a great
It's generally nice.
Good.
Generally nice. The misperceptions are strange. If they're just odd for the most part, I find them to be relatively strange when there are misperceptions. Most of them aren't offensive. Some of them are, but whatever. Hmm. Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
How does it matter?
Great. Thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I'm going to go get my first pedicure. Is your wife available?
Thank you for listening to episode 39 of Someone Who Isn't Me. As you may have gathered over the course of this conversation, the 11th studio album from AFI is available now. It's called Bodies and it's a great record. I'm sure you're already following the band and Davey on the socials already, but remember to go and check out some of, if not all, of the other episodes of Swim, as there are a bunch of incredible guests and the conversations are pretty inspiring, even if I do say so myself. Please follow Swim on the socials, which is at Swim Podcast. I'm at Daniel P. Carter. Subscribe on your preferred pod provider. Leave a nice review wherever you can. Tell your friends that you love them. Look after yourselves. Love is the law. I'm out. Peace.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.